world. Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love, number 196. I'm creator and host, Don Hutchison. Every day, I interview someone from around the world who has discovered her talents to do work she loves, to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Anita Brazies. Anita, welcome.
Thank you so much.
It is our pleasure. Anita, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Absolutely.
All righty. We want to hear the whole story. Anita Brazies is an award-winning journalist specializing in workplace and career issues. She's the author of two career books and has appeared on the Today Show. She's also been quoted in O, the Oprah Magazine, Glamour, Business Week, and USA Today. Her website, 45 Things, was named a top 100 website for women by Forbes Magazine. So Anita, that's a pithy summation of your career right now. Tell us what you're working on that has you engaged and fascinated.
Well, right now, a big part of everything in the world has to do with technology. So it's more than just using it. It's really understanding how it affects everything. And for me, that means in the workplace. So I actually am spending a lot of time reading a lot of research, trying to understand digital transformation and what that means from the employer and employee side.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So what are you discovering?
I'm discovering that in business, it kind of used to be that we all went by our gut. It was a gut instinct when to buy, when to sell. It was a gut instinct when to hire, when to not hire. But now you have so much data collected that companies are saying, you know, this is really valuable information. How can we use it? So instead of hiring somebody based on just a gut instinct, they're going to look at hard data on you. Or instead of giving somebody a promotion based on, oh, the manager feels this person would be a good manager, they're going to look at some hard numbers on you and say, let's look at this person's productivity. Let's look at this person's leadership abilities. Let's look at their training. Do the numbers add up? And this digital transformation is not just in any one department. It's not just in IT. It's not just in marketing. It is going to overhaul companies and the way they do business as nothing we've ever seen before. And I'm a firm believer that if you're an employee, you need to grasp this and get with the program or you will get left behind.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's interesting. There are two sides of that coin, aren't there? On one hand, there's a recent article about, good Lord, the New York Times, I don't remember, it's a big paper, about Amazon and how Amazon appears perhaps to have taken this to the nth degree and to the absurd degree where they've turned workers into automatons. And they've just made the functioning of their job so much like a robotic that people are getting sick and are getting burned out. Some people like it, yes, but other people don't. Then on the other side of the coin, I read in a Forbes article recently that the premium in the workplace today, and this is Forbes, is not on technology or knowledge, but on this human dimension called empathy. So how do you balance the Amazon equation of create really highly efficient people that are just so perfect and get things done so fast, and it doesn't matter that they laid off a pregnant woman because she was pregnant and didn't have any interest in that. They just wanted her to be a worker bee, with the idea that what's missing in the equation is the human element. How do you balance those two?
I think what you have to do is you have to be clear about what you're measuring.
Okay.
I mean, I really don't know that there's a way to measure human beings going through a parent dying or a new baby at home and you're not getting any sleep. For those things, you still need the human empathy.
Yes.
Because that's the only thing that's going to keep workers engaged. And if workers aren't engaged, they won't be productive. At the same time, I actually was asked this question not that long ago, and it had to do with remote workers. And we were talking about the fact that remote workers often have to work twice as hard as anyone else because they're not in the line of vision of a manager. So sometimes they're seen as not working. If you're at home working, you're obviously just watching Oprah reruns and eating granola all day in your pajamas. But I think what the numbers can do, what the data can do, is that they can show the productivity of someone. It's been a gripe of workers forever that the brown nosers get ahead and they're not very productive. Why somebody else is at their desk for 12 hours a day working hard and they don't get ahead because maybe they're introverted, because maybe they don't promote themselves enough. So I think what it's going to need is a balance, and companies have to be very clear with employees about what exactly they're going to measure.
Right. Exactly right. So break that down just for a minute. How do you see that just in a simplified format? I know it's complicated, but how do you see that?
Well, I think number one, it's going to take some training. People need to understand their numbers that they're looking at, because a lot of times you have this disconnect between the technology side and, say, the human resources side. Technology may be measuring something that human resources doesn't want them to measure, but human resources can't translate it so that the tech people know what to look at and what to measure. There's going to be shakeout in the next couple of years for sure, as we all start to learn. But I really think the young workers coming up have a better grasp of how important it is to have that balance in your life while also embracing technology. I think they're going to be really instrumental in getting this balance right.
I hear that. Well, as you well know, everyone's life is composed of turning points every 6 or 7 years. Some call them passages. At these times, we're faced with obstacles and opportunities and choices that determine the next 6 or 7 years of our lives. What about the turning points in your life that have shaped your career and your life to this point? Can you share some of those more impactful ones with our listeners?
Well, I think it started from the time I was able to read. Reading was something I grasped very quickly and loved. And I had two sisters, and one of them, who was 7 years older than I, was an avid reader as well. And so early on, like first, second grade, she was giving me books that were really more suited reading wise for maybe junior high kids. But it was challenging, but I read those difficult books and managed to get through them. And so that kind of set the tone for, I like to challenge myself as a reader. And I think that's an important part of being a writer. Is people always say, well, how do you become a good writer? I said, read good writers, you know, learn what they do, study what they do, study your craft. So reading was something I always loved. I mean, I can remember my mom saying, if you don't put that book down and get your chores done, I mean, it was always that way. Put that book down. And then I think I entered a writing contest when I was 13 on, I think it was something like What America Means to Me. And I remember my social studies teacher, Mrs. Dinsmore, called me at home to tell me that I had won $25.
Oh my gosh.
And it still then, writing wasn't something that I saw as doing for a lifelong pursuit. Back in those days, you know, women went off to become teachers and nurses, and, you know, there really wasn't anything else. And then I hit junior high and Richard Nixon came along and Watergate came along. And I was one of those people that, you know, supported Richard Nixon. I can remember arguing with classmates about it. And then when Woodward and Bernstein exposed everything, that switched something in my brain I can't really describe, but I became a little bit more analytical about things I was reading. Mm-hmm. In my house, my parents read Time, Newsweek, the newspaper. We watched the news. It wasn't an overt thing, but it was very prevalent in our house. And I continued reading a lot of fiction, but I was also reading a lot of news magazines. I can remember reading Sports Illustrated from cover to cover. I just was absorbing everything. And when I was a junior in high school, I needed to fill a time slot for my schedule, and I took a journalism class. And it truly was this way. The very first day I walked in, sat down, she gave us a writing exercise, and I literally felt electrified. I can remember thinking, oh my God, this is the most fantastic thing I've ever been a part of. This is so cool. I love this.
Okay, I can see this. Winning the writing contest at 13. By the way, somebody sent me a piece where Robert Redford won an art contest about that same age, and it was the turning point of his life. So that's pretty interesting, isn't it? That was a big deal, winning that writing contest. And then you get a few years later, you're in this junior high school journalism class. When you say you were electrified, describe that. What about it? What did it feel like to you?
I can remember she put up a bunch of facts on an overhead projector. And she said, there's been a robbery downtown, she said. And here are the facts. This is what the police are releasing. I want you to put this together in as few words as possible, but readable. And she gave us, you know, a time deadline. I forget what it was, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And I did it so easily. And I thought, this is fun. But at the same time, I thought, I want to know more. Why don't we know this from the police? You know, what were these guys wearing? You know, who are they? Where are they from? And I can remember just thinking, it was not only so easy for me, but I was just burning up with curiosity. I just wanted to know more. And I know it was a fake story, but at that point in my life, I was fairly bored in school. I was going to a public school in a small town in Oklahoma, and they were, you know, strapped for resources. There just wasn't a lot. And I was the first one done, and I can remember my teacher saying to me later, she says, I think you've got a gift for this.
Oh,
and
my
I
word.
Said, you bet. I was ready to go.
What did you write? I know you remember. What'd
it was just an opening paragraph of a crime story about these guys. And the trick was to condense this information down as tightly as you could, but in an interesting format in a deadline. And all of those things appealed to me. I am not someone who moves slowly through life. I do everything double time. That's just the way I am.
Okay.
And I'm intensely curious. I mean, I just want to ask a million questions when I meet somebody. And I can just click in my head the facts and writing it shortly. And somebody said to me, what do you do when you have writer's block? And I said, I have never in my life had writer's block. Never. Never. I have never had writer's block. And I know what how that sounds. That may sound smug or something, but it's like saying to somebody, how do you walk? Just walk. You know, it just comes so naturally to me.
Well, this is beautiful. This is really beautiful. So what happened next in the storyline after the junior high first day in class?
She was wonderful. She was a female former newspaper reporter, and she worked on newspapers in the summer. So in my little town, she was all I had to go with. And she saw my excitement, and I worked on the school newspaper, and she managed to get me into the hometown newspaper with some stories that I wrote about what was going on in my high school at the time. And no one in my family had ever gone to college. My sisters had tried and flunked out after the first year. My parents never had the money to go. My dad had been in the Air Force and my mom was a legal secretary. And I started saying from the time I was a junior in high school, I'm going to college and I'm going to become a journalist. You know, my parents couldn't afford a big school or anything, but I went to Oklahoma State, which was about an hour from where I was living at the time, and enrolled in journalism. And they had a philosophy at Oklahoma State at that time, which was they were going to weed out the people who were not serious about journalism. And I think it was my first journalism class, no computers at that time. We were on manual typewriters.
Wow.
And we were in a lab setting, and the instructor walked around and he was doing the imaginary story. Okay, there's a car accident. He was rattling off all these facts and we were writing them down. And he said, you have 20 minutes to get this in. Go. And we all were clacking around on the typewriters, and he would circulate behind us and he would reach over and yank your paper out of the typewriter and say, that's no good. Start over.
Oh, my word.
You know,
wow.
I think half the people were gone by the next day, but it made me more determined. It was tough. I mean, those professors were tough on us. They wanted to know that we were serious about it, but I just loved it. I love talking about stories. I love talking about journalism ethics. I love talking about what was the ethical thing to do in a certain situation. What was the best way to write a story? And all through college, I kept up with it. And I worked on the school newspaper, and in the summers I would go home to my small town, and believe it or not, I worked in the advertising department of the newspaper there.
Oh, did you sell ads?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to work on the news side, but I had a contact in the advertising side who got me the job, and it turned out to be a good thing. And this is what I tell people all the time in school. Don't try and confine yourself to just one thing. Open your mind and explore. And that advertising experience, you know, was helpful. It helped me see, you know, back in the days where you laid out a newspaper by hand, it was important in knowing how color worked on the presses.
Yes.
You know, I learned how to work with the back shop, the guys who laid out the newspaper and did the photos. Later on, when I became the manager,
they
understood all that, and it was real helpful.
They didn't use Linotype, did they?
Yeah.
Oh, they did?
They weren't using computers at that time. That just wasn't it. I really didn't start working on computers until the newsroom of my college paper. And even then it was real basic stuff, but I just kept up with it. And my junior year of college, I won a Reader's Digest scholarship, I guess it was. And I covered the first space shuttle in Houston.
My word. That was a huge
deal.
So
I got to go do that.
Yeah. Unbelievable. So you had to write a story and it was judged. The people all over the country entered stories and you won?
Well, if I remember right, what it was, your professors got to decide who got it. And, you know, it wasn't a lot. I think it was like $500 or $600, but it was enough to get me to Houston and stay for a couple of days and cover the space shuttle and come home. And people always said to me, how were you successful? And I said, I know it sounds trite, but it really was hard work. Other kids might have been out partying, and I'm not saying I didn't do my share in college, but I wasn't missing class. I was getting to know my professors very well. I was asking their advice a lot. Even the retired emeritus professors who would come back to visit, I ask their opinion a lot. Well, what do you think of this newspaper? What do you think of that reporter? What do you think of the way they covered this story? I don't exactly know why I was asking all those questions at the time, other than I was just so interested, and it was valuable to me to hear a lot of different opinions.
Yes, exactly. Amazing. Well, what happened next?
Well, my senior year, I started interviewing at newspapers, and Oklahoma's a great state, but I wanted to leave. I did a lot of reading on my life. I knew there was a big wide world out there and I wanted to leave. And at that time, you know, still my dad had lost his job and was 10 months from retirement, and my parents were broke. And I knew that I needed to get somewhere that wasn't going to cost a lot of money for me to be able to get there. And at that time in Muskogee, Oklahoma, you know, Okie from Muskogee, that was a Gannett newspaper at the time. And Gannett at that time was also the largest chain of newspapers. And I thought, this is my ticket out. If I go to Muskogee for a couple of years, I could transfer then to another newspaper, another state. And that's exactly what I did. I interviewed at Muskogee. I had a lot of clips, a lot of stories to show them. When you come out of journalism school, you have actually been an apprentice for many years. You don't get to graduate without having actually done news stories, covered actual stories, and done the time. So you hit the ground running when you come out of college. And I did. And I was in Muskogee for 2.5 years, and I covered murders and police and courts. And, you know, I covered the county fair, and I was called out in the middle of the night, and I just lived and breathed. Absolutely loved it. Wow. Couldn't get enough of it.
Wow. Was it a pretty sophisticated environment as far as the quality of the writing and everything?
Yes, we were award-winning. It was a great group of journalists. We won photo awards. We won news awards. We broke major news stories. But to be honest with you, after 2.5 years, I was getting a little burned out. I was exhausted. You know, I was a single woman, and it was just a lot to take on, especially some of the more gruesome things. We had a high murder rate.
Oh, wow.
Covering a lot of those was burning me out. So I asked to be transferred to Springfield, Missouri. And fortunately, I got that job and went to Springfield. I was only there 6 months, and my boss called me into his office. He said, how would you like to go to USA Today?
Oh, my word.
He said, when do I leave?
Yes.
And literally, I went to USA Today within 2 days. I was working on the state's desk at USA Today. And
well, how did that work? How did they pick you out of Springfield, Missouri? Were they part of that network or something?
At that time, USA Today was operating with what they call loaners. And that meant that the various newspapers around the country loaned you to USA Today. That kept down the cost for USA Today because the home newspaper had to still pick up your salary for the time you were gone. And then USA Today could use you and then send you back. The problem was USA Today was not sending people back, and the home newspapers were getting really angry.
Right.
You know, they were getting really fed up with sending reporters or photographers or editors and not getting them back. So at the end of my stint, USA Today said to me, do you want to stay? And I said, well, yes. And my home newspaper said, absolutely not. You have to send her home. We don't have the money to keep paying her up there. And it was quite a fight. And my home newspaper said, we need you to come home. And I said, gee, no, I don't think I'm going to.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I also had fallen in love with somebody at USA Today, a guy I worked with, and there was no way I was leaving. So
right.
It was a very amicable parting. Everybody understood. And 8 days later, I went to work for Fairchild Publications in Washington, D.C., which is the newspapers that put out Women's Wear Daily. And I was an economics reporter and covered Capitol Hill and hated it. Absolutely hated it.
Was it just too dry?
Yeah, that was a part of it. I didn't like the atmosphere was pretty unfriendly at that time. The bureau was pretty, had a lot of strife. And what I also didn't like, one of the things I loved about what I did was I felt like what I did made a difference. I was covering important stories. I was interviewing people who wanted their voices to be heard, because at that time there was no internet. There was no way for people to have their voices heard unless you reported it and put it out there for them. And there was a lot of times I really felt like I was the only thing standing up for some of these people. And when I got to Capitol Hill, it was a real herd mentality. I mean, there might be 10, 12 20 reporters covering one tax reform hearing. And we were all writing the same thing and hearing the same thing. And it wasn't something that appealed to me. And so I continued to do that for about a year and a half. And then I took a job with a group of magazines outside of Washington, D.C. in McLean, Virginia, which is where the CIA is, which this is a fun fact. I used to shop at the same drugstore as some of the Supreme Court justices who also live there. That's kind of a weird feeling to walk in and see the Supreme Court justice buying toothpaste. But I have it. And one of the magazines they had was called Employee Benefit News, and they were just starting it. And they said, you know, we think employee benefits and employees in the workplace is going to be a big thing. And they were right. This was more than 25 years ago, and they were one of the first magazines out there doing it. So I did that for 3 years, and I became very knowledgeable about employee benefits, human resources, the laws regarding employees and workplaces, all those things. And I did that for 3 years, and then I got pregnant with my first son. And my husband at that time was still at USA Today. And he said, you know, I really think I want to go back to community journalism. I was like, really? Now? I'm 9 months pregnant. Really? Now you want to move? And sure enough, we did. 2 weeks after the day that my first son was born, we moved from Washington, D.C. to Pensacola, Florida, which is where he worked at the newspaper there as a deputy managing editor. And I started freelancing. And to be honest with you, I was one of the first people out there really kind of doing what I was doing, which is at that point you had computers. Right. So I didn't have to be in an office. I could still work for the magazine I worked for. I just had a computer. You had a disk, yeah, and you had to overnight it to the magazine with your stories, but it was doable. I mean, for the first time, it was something that you could do and you did not have to be in that office. I mean, that was a real game changer, I think, in journalism and in writing.
Yes. Let me ask you a question at this point in the storyline. This is great. What is it about the fact that, or why is it, do you think, and you've had you're a journalist, so you think about all these issues. Why is it that Gallup points out to us decades of studies, that Gallup and others, that most people are not able to, the majority of people in the 80 percentiles around the world and the 70 percentiles, even in this country, when asked by Gallup, are you using your talents, are you using your skills every day to do your best work? People say no. What is that about?
Well, you know, I think what it is a lot of people don't see how to translate what they like to do into more than one thing. Say, for example, I've always loved baseball and I wanted to be a professional baseball player. Well, you know, that's a pretty narrow field. And chances are that you may not get to be a professional baseball player. But that does not mean you can't use your talents to be doing something you love. I interviewed a man one time who this was the case. He wanted to be a professional baseball player and it just was not in the cards for him. So he went to school and he got an accounting degree and blah, blah, blah. And he's just so miserable. And then all of a sudden he met somebody with the minor league baseball team where he was. I think it was Tacoma, Washington. And lo and behold, he ended up becoming an accountant at the minor league baseball team.
Right.
So he did his job, but he spent his lunch hours watching them practice on the field. And there was lots of events that he could participate in. And he said he was so much happier. And I just think that a lot of times people have such a narrow focus of what, if they can't do this one specific thing, well, gee whiz, that door is closed to me. And I understand that because newspapers have folded right and left. And there were a lot of magazines that I worked for that closed. And there was a couple of years for me where I thought I'm going to have to go out and just work at Hobby Lobby or somewhere. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I didn't give up and I kept talking to people and I kind of poked around online and there was this new thing called blogging and there was this new thing called social media. And so I went to a bloggers conference and I remember I went to this one bloggers conference and they said, there's this new thing called Twitter. Try it. And I was like, okay. So I tried that. There was a lot of things I tried that didn't work, but I just kind of kept at it because I still liked doing that. I still liked writing. I still liked asking questions. I still liked gathering information. So I just kind of kept doing that. After a couple of years of doing that, guess what? They needed writers online.
Right.
People were desperate for writers online. They fired all the journalists. All the journalists had gone off to do other things. There weren't journalists online. A lot of them who knew how to use social media, who knew all those things. But guess what? Anita Brusese did because she poked around doing it for 2 years. I really didn't have a plan, but I just kept kind of keeping my hand in the things that I liked.
Yes. See, I think that's very savvy advice. There are a lot of ways to get there, and it's not, that guy, the baseball story is perfect. We talked to a guy recently that was a tech designer and did production, and he couldn't get exactly the job he wanted in that field because it required too much travel and et cetera, et cetera. So he went into a whole other area for several years. He did fine, but he was miserable, but he stayed with his interest in tech. And finally, something opened up where he could get what he wanted, the terms that he wanted, but he never lost the connection to his passion. So just like your accountant that loved baseball, being an accountant for a minor league baseball team, or you going through the transition where journalists are in demand, so you understood internet marketing. Those are perfect examples of just what you're saying.
I think millennials get it more than some of the older workers. Millennials have these interests. Like, for example, the guy who does my website for me and everything, that's where he earns his living. But he loves music. So he took his web job and moved to Austin, where there is a really vital music community.
Huge.
And that way he can do both. He can pay his bills, but he has this community of people where he gets to share his passion, and he's so happy doing that. And I don't know that one day, I mean, he may go full-time music.
Right.
But he just kind of shifted gears. He was up in Boston, and there wasn't the kind of music he was interested in. He talked his employer into letting him work remotely from Austin so that he could have that presence of music in his life.
Exactly. No, it makes total sense. So what aspects of your life have been most affected, most positively affected by you choosing the road less traveled, or you following your truth and your passions?
I'm not sure I understand what you're asking.
In your life, you have known from an early age what you were good at. You've continued to improve your skills and grow your talents. You've used them, and you chiseled out a life on your terms, pretty much. So what are the benefits of you chiseling out that life on your terms to mostly do work that you love? What are the benefits to you?
I'm happy.
Okay.
I'm happy. And when you're happy, you make other people happy. I have a wonderful marriage and children, and they're all happy and doing well. And I think that's because I'm happy and doing well. You know, I've been through some tough times, but who hasn't? There's been tough things in my life. But I don't think that if it only as just writing, because it's been a calling. You know, when I got into it, felt so passionately about it after Watergate, I really saw the benefit of keeping people informed. And I know now that everybody puts all kinds of information out there any which way they want it. But I really still follow the same training that I had. There are lines in my life that I don't cross. There's the integrity part of it that still just deal in facts. I don't deal in rumors.
Yes.
I still keep in contact with journalists that I respect and value. And when things were shifting so fast online and everybody was getting into the writing and saying, oh, what do we need journalists for and everything? Well, I think we see why we need journalists. Journalists go through, I don't think people appreciate the amount of training we go through to do what we do. And, you know, there's always people out there who call themselves journalists, and they're really, in my mind, not, because they're not following the path that they were trained to do, you know, which is sticking to the facts and putting out impartial information. But I still kind of like my own personal thing where I'm very proud of what I've done. I think it's made a difference for people. I know it's made a difference for people. I've had hundreds of letters over the years from people saying, I thought I was the only one dealing with the bully boss at work, or I thought I was the only one going through this at work. And I read your column, I read your story, and it really helped me just to know that I'm not alone and I'm not helpless.
Yes. What would you say? You've also written some books on career. What are a few tips briefly that you would give to people, whether they're 18 heading off to college or trade school or in the work world, or their, you know, middle career? What would you say to them about their getting what they want out of their career?
I think a lot of people get complacent and they think, well, this pays the bills, so that's what's important. And when you get complacent in your career, then you don't ask questions. You're no longer that interested. You get kind of bored. You get kind of lazy. You start cutting corners and you start feeling this unhappiness with yourself, and you're blaming it on the job or you're blaming it on your boss. And I'm not saying that all bosses are wonderful, but a lot of times that unhappiness comes because you are cutting corners, because you know that you are better than that and you're not doing your best at the time. So I think you have to be vigilant.
Yes.
I think that you have to be kind of always feeling like you're self-employed. You have to do that gut check on yourself. Am I doing the best? Is this the best that I could do? Am I making the best use of my talents? Am I contributing what I should? Do I feel good at the end of the day? And a lot of people say, well, that's just the way it is. There's nothing else. Well, I don't believe that. I mean, I've been in that position where you feel hopeless, but you can't just give up. I think when people give up is when they lapse into that misery.
I agree. I totally agree. I think you should never give up no matter what. So have there been books that, here you are, this voracious reader, that have inspired you in your journey on any aspect of your life and career?
It's funny, To Kill a Mockingbird has become like the book du jour, but I read that on my own. Gosh, I think I must have been 14. That really stuck with me, that part about the justice of it.
Yes.
That book was one of those ones. And this is also funny. Anna Green Gables, I read in, I think, first grade. My sister gave it to me. One of the things I loved about Anne was how curious she was. Mm-hmm. Nobody could ever take that away from her, how curious she was. And I was a curious kid. I was quiet, but I was always the one with my nose in a book, wanting to know more. I ran into somebody who knew me when I was young, and she says, the thing I remember about you is that you always talked about things you wanted to do, places you wanted to go. I mean, I wasn't real adventurous. You know, it wasn't like I wanted to climb Mount Everest or anything like that. But I just needed to know and do and see for myself. That's kind of how I was. So those were books that were, I know it sounds weird, Anna Green Gables and To Kill a Mockingbird, but those stuck out in my mind.
That's perfect. So this internet thing, you went from being a classical journalist and learning blogging from the ground up and social media and so forth. How do you use this amazing thing called the internet in your life and career?
Well, it sure does make life a lot easier as far as doing research. I mean, because that's the other thing I think people never realize about journalists is I never wrote anything that I didn't verify with two people or I didn't check out. So I feel like in the first part of my journalism career, I probably walked, when I was covering a police beat and those kind of things, I bet I walked 10, 12 miles a day easy.
Oh.
That because you were just back and forth and back and forth to the police station. You went to the courts. You went out to somebody's house to talk to a murder victim's family. You just went and saw and did for yourself. And then when you couldn't do that, you were on the phone and the phone practically grew out of your head. Now, you know, with the internet, there's a lot of things I can check easily. You know, I can find the study online that I need to find. I can find the research. I can find the spelling of someone's name. You know, I can verify all of that. But I still call and interview people all the time. Some people want just emails. They just want me to email them questions, but I really would prefer to talk to them over the phone. I think you get much more information. I think you convey the information better. It's not as dry. You know, I always say at the end of every interview, is there anything I did not ask you that you would like to add? And that's the best question there is, because you would not believe the little gems that people will say that nobody ever thought to ask them or give them a chance to say, you know, just kind of really what they think about something. And to me, that's the best part of the interview is when they say that part at the end.
You know, it's funny. It just gives them permission to uncover something out of their subconscious that they would not have come up with if you asked them the traditional questions, right?
Right, exactly. And I think we all spend a lot of time talking and sometimes we don't spend enough time listening. And so sometimes it takes people aback to say, what else do you want to tell me? I'm right. going to sit here until you tell me something. And right. they're just like, wow, gee, okay, well, X, Y, Z, I wanted to add this.
I wonder how many murder cases have been solved by clever journalists or detectives waiting out the person you're interviewing and asking that question and letting it percolate up. I bet you a lot have been solved that way.
Well, I think that's true. And I've interviewed a lot of CIA and FBI officers, and they will always talk about the power of silence. And when you go to journalism school, In addition to teaching you to read upside down, isn't that funny? They teach you to read upside down because you never know we're going to be sitting at somebody's desk and you want to read upside down what they have on their desk.
Are you serious? They really teach you that?
Yeah. They tell you, learn to read upside down. But I think that now I forget what I was going to say when I did the read upside down thing.
Let's see.
Oh, about the power of silence.
Yeah, precisely.
The CIA and FBI agents will tell you that silence makes people uncomfortable.
Right.
And they will feel it. They will start to say something. And they've often gotten people to say things they might not otherwise. I often think of that when I see social media online, is that there's no way to give somebody that opportunity right. sometimes. Because
right.
we, lots of times we're talking at people, right. not with them on social media.
Most of the time.
And so you miss that opportunity to give them that silence to let them try and fill it.
Yes, exactly. This is perfect. This is actually a book I like called Time to Think. So what are you proudest of? What are you proudest of in your life today?
Well, my family.
Okay.
I have two wonderful sons and a wonderful husband. I'm proud of my work. I'm proud of the fact that I've helped people. I'm proud of the fact that, you know, there's been some stories when I've exposed wrongdoing and made people see it in the light of day, what the truth is. I'm proud of the fact that I've made people think, that I've made them think and made them feel like they're not powerless. To me, that's the saddest thing of all when I talk to someone and they feel hopeless and powerless. I interviewed a man when the recession first started and oh my gosh, it was awful. He could not get a job and he had these kids and the despair in his voice was just awful. And I interviewed him and then he dropped off the radar and I was so worried about him. I did not know what had happened to him and I kept trying to find him and he wasn't responding and I was so worried what had happened to him. And a couple of years later, I saw him pop up online and he had a job. But that kind of stuff, I was so worried about the despair I heard in his voice and I tried to help and I've tried to do that many times where people contact me and they don't know where to turn. I had a woman one time scare me so bad, she sent me a letter and she was so full of despair that I immediately contacted the newspaper in her hometown and gave her name and said, can you check on her? And they said right away. And they checked on her and they said, we've referred her to social services. Those are the people that I feel like there was a reason they reached out to me and I couldn't not help. And it didn't matter that I was a journalist or not, but it's always in me to try and help. And so those are the things I feel good about.
Yes, I hear you. Anita Brzees, what a great pleasure being with you today. We appreciate you sharing the highlights of your life journey. And I know that listeners around the world have learned lessons that will help them on theirs. So how do those listeners get in touch with you?
At Anita Brzees. They can always contact me through my website. My email's on there, anita@anitabrzees.com. My phone's on there. You know, it's really best to contact me through email because that way I have an answer
okay.
for you. Because
okay.
a lot of times people say to me, do you have a resource for this? Who can I talk to for this? It might take me a minute or two to find somebody who I think can help you or give you a resource I think might help.
Yes. Yes. Good. Listeners can go to discovertalentpodcast.com, put in Anita Brzees, B-R-U-Z-Z-E-S-E, and get the highlights of this fine interview as well as the links that she just described. Thank you, listeners across the world, for joining us today. You know that you can go to our website. You can find an infographic based on an ebook, What Do Highly Successful People Actually Do to Succeed? 12 Proven Career Building Strategies to Help You Do What You Love. These are ideas from the masters, the men and women over decades or even centuries that have given us wisdom about these thorny topics, and readers have found it useful. It's free, so please take advantage of it. You can also subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you like our content, join our tribe. We'd like to have you a part of it. We'd like to hear from you and know how we can serve you better. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We do not learn them. We cannot ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive, we thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.